We are in Boston at the Harvard Club, which is where they're holding the 6th annual Harvard Stem Cell Institute Stem Cell Symposium. Doug Melton is co-director of the Harvard Stem Cell Institute, as well as being professor of natural sciences at Harvard and an investigator of the Howard Hughes Medical Institute and a well-known investigator of stem cell issues about diabetes. You published a paper in September of this year, September 2009. Using the latest technology, the induced pluripotent stem cell technology, IPS technologies, to deal with one of the problems of type 1 diabetes. Could you just explain that?
Yes, I mean, type 1 diabetes, like many degenerative diseases, is complicated. That a person gets the disease in part because of the genes they have, but also some environmental signal. Worse yet, we don't know what kicks off the disease, what causes it. And so the only way biomedical scientists have been able to study it is to wait for a patient to get the disease. They come to their clinic, and by then the disease is really in full force. So it's quite hard to understand what was the initial cause. We think it's quite important to know what causes the disease in order to design a new treatment or a new therapy. So stem cells enable one to get at the initial cause, what I like to call the root cause, without having to study the disease in patients. Obviously, one's not going to take 100 children and monitor them every day and wait for one of them to get diabetes. That's not a sensible approach. But if we could make a stem cell that captures all the genes from a patient and then turn that stem cell into the kinds of cells involved in the disease, we can then do what I would call reconstruct type 1 diabetes, but now reconstruct it not in a person, but in a kind of living test tube in an immunocompromised mouse. So this paper reported the first production of a pluripotent stem cell from patients with type 1 diabetes, and it showed that those cells could be turned into insulin-producing cells. Our challenge now is to turn those same cells into cells of the thymus, where the immune system is educated between self and non-self, and to the players in the immune system, the T cells and the B cells. So the thought experiment, the one we're aiming for, is say 2 years from now. We want to put all those components together in this living test tube, in this compromised mouse, and watch it get not only diabetes, but this would be human diabetes because they're human cells. If that works, we're in great shape. Then we can really look at it at every moment. Let me give an analogy that when you've had diabetes, it's like a car accident. And you come to the car accident 3 days after the accident, and I tell you what was the cause. That's really a problematic puzzle. But if it turned out at that intersection there had been a movie camera, and you could play the movie over and over again, you might see the driver looked at his cell phone, or a bicyclist cut in front or something. That's what we're trying to do, is to make a movie of how a human gets diabetes without using people, but using human cells.
So you've got the end product, but you need the mechanism.
That's right. You could say, well, why do you want the mechanism? I think most scientists would say, if you know mechanism, you are in a really good position to then design a new therapy. While it's true that many of our drugs work without the mechanism being understood, then you're kind of counting on luck, and this might take longer, but this kind of systematic approach is likely to work.
So two problems. In type 1 diabetes, beta cells are being killed off. So one thing you can do is to produce more beta cells and get them into the system.
Right.
Underlying that is still the fundamental cause, which is an autoimmune compromised system, which is killing off beta cells.
Exactly. Very well said. And so that means that even if we solve the first problem, if we could make a bucket of beta cells, if we put those into a patient, their immune system will say, thank you very much, I recognize those cells, I'm going to kill them. So we have to solve two prongs of the problem. One is produce more beta cells, and the other is block the immune attack or eliminate it. And I'm confident now with stem cell biologists working here and California and all the world over, we're getting closer all the time to making beta cells. We heard two or three talks today about that. So now I want to turn some of my lab's attention to this autoimmune problem.
One of the second talks was Ed Betje from NovaCell, and you mentioned this in your talk. The second issue, how do you get into the system stealthily, right, without being recognized, right, and attacked and savaged.
Yes.
And you talked about encapsulation to some extent. Mm-hmm. Could you explain that a little
yes,
bit?
Yes, so the Nova Cell approach, which is quite a good one, is to say the immune system is very complicated. It might take years to solve that problem of blocking the biology of the immune system. So could we prevent it just with a mechanical device? Ed sometimes talks about it as a tea bag, which I like. So imagine you put the beta cells into a little tea bag and put that inside the patient. Well, the bad immune cells that attack and kill the beta cells can't get through the tea bag.
Right.
But importantly, glucose, sugar, and insulin, the hormone, can cross through the tea bag.
Because that inflammation has
That's
to happen.
That's right. That so has to happen. And so I would say it would be unfair to call it a halfway solution. It's a big step forward if they can achieve that, because that also has the advantage that if the tea bag breaks and doesn't work, you can go get another one. So any patient would tell you they would be glad to go into an outpatient clinic one day a year to get two tea bags put in them, rather than taking 10 blood tests a day and injecting themselves with insulin every day. So it would be a complete game-changing event if NovaCell can do that.
Okay, so it's pretty generally widely known that you have a personal interest in this. I mean, you were one of the Time 100 in 2007, 2009. Orrin Hatch wrote The Appreciation, this latest one. I was reading a New Scientist conversation with Roger Highfield, I think, in which I think it was mentioned that there were a series of steps to solving this problem as you saw it, and you got through the first two, and your son Sam, who was diagnosed with type 1 diabetes in 1993, had said essentially, what's taking so long?
I mean, that's right.
What is the time scale and the prognosis?
It's a good point, because to a scientist, seeing the enormity of the problem, progress is measured in steps, to say that I've divided this problem into six steps and we've solved two of them.
Yeah.
I wish as much as my son Sam and all other diabetics that they'd been solved a long time ago. So you could say, is the glass a quarter full or three quarters empty? I would say it's a quarter full, because we don't find any aspects of this challenge, of this enterprise, that are unsolvable. This is a solvable problem. What it requires are good, smart young people and resources, but it is absolutely a solvable problem. At the same time, I'm completely sympathetic with patients who say, how can we be spending so much money on healthcare? We have the world's biggest pharmaceutical companies. We have all these universities, all these scientists. How come my disease hasn't been cured? I get that. I understand that. And I'm sorry to say the answer is it's hard. These aren't easy problems to solve. I wish they were easy, but they're not. They're hard problems.
And there are political nuances here. There are ethical nuances. You came up with 17 stem cell lines and
yes,
made them available. And
yes, I wouldn't put too much attention on making the stem cell lines. There's the excitement about iPS cells, and we've now made 72 stem cell lines, which we give out to everyone the world over. But let's not forget that's the starting material. That's the reagent, right? If we were artists and we were going to make sculptures, clay sculptures, all we're talking about is getting the clay. We still have to use it to make something. Looking back on the political trouble with that, the political hurdles were much higher than the ethical ones. More or less, our whole nation came to agree that if something was going to be thrown away, it made sense that you could use it to try to find cures for disease. The political aspects are different, and there I would say, unfortunately, the last 8 years, 9 years of the Bush administration did not do anything other than slow down this research. It didn't make the research get done any more wisely, more carefully, more ethically. It didn't stop it. It just slowed it down. So I don't want to think about that period anymore. Let's get on with it and get to solutions.
Yeah, I noticed that you were applauding that the sort of British model seemed to have been a better way to go about things.
Absolutely. There are many good things I liked about studying in Britain, many good things I like about their white papers. This is a place where I think other nations should take note. They did a careful study, had leaders think about it, and came up with, you could call it a compromise, you could call it regulations, whatever you want to call it. I would call it a work plan. which we don't really have in this country.
Yeah. You mentioned that you went to Cambridge. Mm. Two interesting things there that I want to ask you about. One is that your first degree there was in history and philosophy of science, which is very mm-hmm. intriguing. And then you went into molecular biology, and your advisor was John Gurdon, who just with Shinya Yamanaka got this year's Lasker Award, although their work was separated by 50 years, but it's right. very smart to make that link. Mm-hmm. Do you want to sort of give me some sense of that transition and how you got into the history and philosophy of science and then the shift?
Although it's sort of self-indulgent to give a personal history of it, but I'd say that when I was a young boy, I found and still find philosophy quite interesting, including the history and philosophy of science, and I imagined that I could make a unique contribution. When I went to Cambridge, I learned that the best I was likely to do was comment on what other very smart people did. And yet, in experimental science, you can do things uniquely that really make a difference if you're lucky. And luck, people don't like to hear about luck, but I was extremely lucky, fortunate, you might say, that John Gurdon would take me in as a foreign graduate student. It was a wonderful period of life, and it was just a pleasure to have him as a mentor.
Well, I'm just interested in the transition, because you're walking around with a history and philosophy of science BA from Cambridge, and here's this foremost experimental person. How do you persuade somebody to take you on?
You might ask John that, but what he will tell you that I asked if I could wash dishes in the lab as a way to, because I had read John's Scientific American paper on cloning a frog.
Right.
And even now, decades later, it's one of the coolest experiments I've ever read about. Yeah. And I just thought, I want to meet him and work on that problem. So it wasn't any grand life plan. It was sort of a history of luck and accident.
So you just walked into the department?
Yeah, made an appointment and said, could I help out washing dishes to get some chance at experimental science? But ask John the story.
In your talk, you talked about three ways of making beta cells. And there was the directed differentiation, right? And you also talked about replication. And then about direct reprogramming or transdifferentiation. And you also talked in the process of all of this about educating cells. Could you unpack that a little bit?
Yeah, I like to think about education of a cell as a good analogy for thinking about the puzzle we have. To go from, say, kindergarten or grade school to an adult as a fully differentiated, educated cell. So in some sense, what we do as biologists is we try to understand or write the molecular biography of a cell. So when we think about the biography of a person, we think of who made that person what they are, their parents, their friends, their teachers. And it's similar with a cell. A cell is educated as to what kind of cell it should become. It first makes a decision, I might be part of the gut tube. Then within the gut tube, I might be a lung or a liver or a pancreatic cell, etc. And so programming and reprogramming is all about educating a cell, or if you like, erasing its education. So I can make an analogy on directed differentiation from a stem cell and contrast that with lineage reprogramming. So here's the analogy. If you're a lawyer and you want to become a doctor, the way many people in biology think about doing that is take the lawyer and de-differentiate, completely reprogram back to kindergarten, and then educate them into a doctor. Direct lineage reprogramming is to say, no, you're a lawyer, you go right to med school and become a doctor. So that's a sort of useful analogy of the difference of going all the way back to the beginning or switching from one profession to another, from one cell type to another. And I think education is a nice analogy because we've all had some education and we all know that it's not simple. It's not like you learn mathematics in a day or you learn appreciation of art in a day. It takes a while to teach a person or a cell what it's going to become.
Yeah. I think the emphasis that has come out, though, has been on reprogramming, hasn't it?
Yes, it's been on going back to kindergarten.
Right.
And so this the other approach of lineage reprogramming or what we called transdifferentiation, might be faster and easier.
So in the talks that we've heard for the rest of the day, could you give me some sense of was there new sense, new stuff there for you? Was there some sense of were you excited about it?
Yes, I'd say in the afternoon talks, there were three things that popped to mind. One is Jacob Hanna talked about trying to finally understand why this famous non-obese diabetic or this NOD mouse gets diabetes. And so most people use the mouse once it has diabetes to say that's now the equivalent of a patient. And he's asking the question of, can we dissect the process to figure out how that mouse got diabetes? And that's an exact parallel to what I proposed using human cells, though, instead of mouse cells. The next talk by Armand, I thought was quite interesting because there are these wonderful properties of mesenchymal cells and mesenchymal stem cells. But as he rightly said, oddly enough, that field is at the position of trying to purify them and know what cell we're all talking about. Is it one cell or many? And I say oddly enough because in some countries, Germany in particular, these uncharacterized cells are being put into cardiac patients to try to improve heart function. And many people think that that's a bit premature. The last talk by John Graff made a couple of points. The one that struck me most is this puzzle of where do our new fat cells come from? Are they coursing through the blood? Are they found in our bone marrow? And his studies suggest, but don't yet prove, that when you make more fat, like here in my belly, that I don't want, it's because there are these little fat stem cells sitting in the blood vessels of my fat, and they're just popping off new fat cells. It was a suggestion, not a proof, but I found that quite interesting.
So, in fact, this the elaboration of this, the use of new technologies and so on, as almost always with science, with good science, the more discoveries you make, the more discoveries you discover you have to make.
Yes, that's well put. And it, as one often says, it raises more questions. And I think that what we're seeing now in this field of stem cell science, which separates it a bit from a pure academic science, is that people realize there are so many questions that could be asked. But as a community, we're trying to focus on those that make a difference to patients. So there's one thing to say, I'd like to be able to describe how the body is made and maintained, just as a pure scientist would like to know how it is that we go from an egg to an adult. But I think the stem cell community, I'm pleased to say, is saying, well, that's an interesting question, but it's especially interesting as it informs our thinking about how to treat disease. So disease is always in the corner. It's always in the room. It's always mapped onto these questions, because if the question were just how do you make a tissue or an organ, you might say, well, maybe the easiest one for me to study is my fingernail. But fingernail disease isn't really a very big issue as far as I know. Okay? And so we focus on the major degenerative diseases.
There was a piece in a news feature in Nature in April of this year talking about the field of induced pluripotent stem cells and the huge explosion. It's gone from standing start to headlong rush in less than 3 years, it says. And there's a sense here that there's a lot of competition going on. There's a comment from Rudy Janisch here saying it's not healthy, it's overheated, and so on and so forth. Inevitable that a new exciting field will produce all this. But give me some sense you talked about the community of stem cells. So that's a collaborative term.
Yes.
This is...
Well, it's an interesting question about how much competition is healthy and how much is harmful. In my view, it's silly and harmful to have many young people doing the same experiment. On the other hand, no community should ever entrust one important problem to one person or one lab because it's too risky. And so in institutes, and in places like this, the California Institute for Regenerative Medicine, it's good to have a little bit of overlap, a lot of openness about what people are doing, but in no sense say one group, you should do this or you shouldn't do that. So Professor Janisch's comment may be right for the moment, but my guess is it sorts itself out quite quickly. A year from now, there will not be so many people trying to make iPS cells. It's at one point a problem largely solved, and then at another point becomes fundamentally uninteresting. It's not interesting to just say my goal is to make stem cells from every patient. It's a nice analogy might be there was a lot of competition in rushing to sequence the human genome, mm-hmm. and then we created that facility, that sequencing engine, let's say, and now there's a lot of sequencing of other genomes. But it's just not interesting to say our goal is to sequence every organism on the planet, because I don't know what we'd do with all of that information. It's just not an interesting question. So I would say the challenge for, say, the leaders of the CRM, the California Institute, for example, would be how do you manage the right amount of healthy competition? Competition makes us all say that I want to do better. I'm being challenged by my colleagues, if it's in sport or in business or anything. But competition can get overwrought when it's then positively harmful.
This is the sixth annual symposium at the Harvard Stem Cell Institute, the Malkin Symposium. Mm-hmm. Quick summary of 6 years, how it's gone, how you feel about this?
That's a good question, because I often think about that, is what's happened more quickly than I thought and what's taking too long. I would say that in general, the promise that scientists made to the public and to themselves about the potential of this field has borne out to be true, that we've learned an enormous amount about how to turn stem cells into cardiomyocytes, into other cell types. There are other areas where we have been disappointed, I think, in the lack of promise. We're not seeing cells being put into patients for the number of diseases that we would like. The regulatory issues haven't become simpler. We've had an impediment, a governor, by the political nonsense in this country, regulating the activities. That's now been lifted. I see it from the point of view of undergraduates, graduate students, and postdocs, that it's an enormously exciting field where they can make unique and important contributions. So 5 or 6 years after we started, I'm delighted with where we are. I have great hope for the future, but I'll only be happy when we're treating diseases.
Which is what started you on this in the first place, actually.
Yes.
How do you report back to, what are your children's names, Sam and
Sam
Emma?
Sam and Emma.
How do you report back?
I report back truthfully that there's progress, that I like to tell them that everything we learn tells me that type 1 diabetes is a solvable problem. Yeah. I wish I could tell them it'll happen this year or next year, but because it depends on science, and what I mean by that, on discovery, I wish I knew how to predict discoveries, when they'll happen, I don't. But the more people we have engaged in it, the better our chances are.
A couple of things here that I just would like to get your thought on. These are papers from Cell, mm-hmm. Cell magazine. One says, cancer stem cells, controversial or just misunderstood. And in fact, this is about, there have been covers of Time or Newsweek magazine. Mm-hmm. Again, some confusion, public confusion about, okay, stem cells proliferate, cancer proliferates. Mm-hmm. What's the difference?
Well, I think I'm not the expert on cancer stem cells, but I think what's fair to say is the idea that there can be an undifferentiated cancer cell that you'd call a stem cell that's responsible for remission of tumors is a very good idea, one worth pursuing, and a number of groups all over the world are actively pursuing that. It would be wrong to say that stem cell biology is the answer to the problem of cancer. But I think it's going to be a very important, not just tool, but way of thinking about cancers to develop new drugs. So I think it's extremely promising.
And there's another paper here by Giuseppe Testa which says, what to do with the grail now that we have it? iPSC's potentiality in public policy. So again, this whole notion of how the debate gets into the public arena as well.
Yes. It could be that my problem, if I have a problem, is having studied the history of science, is I don't expect solutions in a year or two. Right. And so there is a natural tendency from the press and the business community to expect there to be news. We have quarterly reports. Well, I would point out that if I have one or two good ideas a year, that's been a very good year. So when reporters call me and say, what's new? I say, well, excuse me, I just talked to you last week. Things just don't happen that quickly. And so similarly, I'm not sure what Giuseppe is thinking about there. I wouldn't say iPSLs were the holy grail. They're another very useful reagent, a stem cell that we can make patient-specific. Now the challenge is how to make them without oncogenes and viruses, then to find out, can they truly make a physiologically normal cell that represents the interesting cells, and by which I mean interesting here defined as those which are lost in degenerative disease. And that will come. But if anyone's saying we're going to do this in 1 year or 2 years, they either have some deep insight or connection to when discoveries will happen that I don't, or it is, as my philosophy teacher used to say, language on holiday.
Who taught you philosophy at Cambridge?
That man who said that was named Buchdahl, Professor Buchdahl.
Buchdahl?
In fact, he used to, yes, Gerd, yeah. Do you know Gerd? He used to say that to me. He used to say, Melton, that's language on holiday.
In the panorama of ideas and so on, who, if you had a chance to have dinner with somebody, anyone from history, who actually caught your attention as you were studying?
Oh, you mean who's not alive now? Because
yeah,
my favorite person now is John Gurdon. I still enjoy all my dinners with
him. Well,
John.
I'm sure he'll be delighted to hear that.
I would say the two people I'd like to have at the same time would be Giordano Bruno and Galileo Galilei, who were treated differently by the church for their beliefs. Bruno died at the stake, as you know, in Piazza della Fiore. There's a wonderful statue of him there. And Galileo didn't. But they had to wrestle with the importance of ideas in a way that most scientists now don't. Would you die for an idea?
And you wrestle with that idea?
No. But the other advantage, of course, of picking them is we would have Italian food, which I like.
Ah, so. There you are. Actually good. One final question.
Okay.
What are you optimistic about?
I'm very optimistic about curing type 1 diabetes. And I think curing is a very ambitious thing to say, but I don't just mean treating it, but curing it. As I said just a minute ago, I don't see any reason to think that we can't solve that problem. We can learn what is the cause of the immune attack, and we can make new beta cells. So I'm optimistic about a day when my children and the millions of others don't read their blood sugar and inject insulin.
In his inaugural address, and this, I promise mm-hmm. this is the last uh-huh. question, in his inaugural address, President Obama talked about, and later at the National Academy's presentation, he talked about restoring science to its rightful place. Mm. So in your, do you have a sense of what the rightful place of science is in this forthcoming year, 2010, 350th mm. anniversary of the foundation of the Royal Society? Long business.
I think I do, which is to say that the public has a sort of obligation and the ability to know about how scientists ask and answer questions. Scientific answers aren't the only answers to the important questions of life, but it would be folly to set them aside and only look for religious answers or other kinds of spiritual answers. Scientific answers have real meaning and force, in a minimum, in manipulating the world and effects on our economy. So I'm a very strong believer that scientists therefore have an obligation to explain to the public what we find interesting, how we go about doing it, and what kind of answers we have, meaning what are their limitations and what are their values, or the value of the answer. And I don't think scientists do as good a job as that as they could. So in a sense, I'm hearkening back to C.P. Snow's Two Cultures, and I think it's to society's danger to accept the idea that there are two cultures and let that gap or that divide grow.
Okay, Doug Melton, thanks very much.
Well, thanks for having me.